Quicker than you'd imagine for his bulk, reaching for the spitter. I grabbed the pulse rifle, rolling to squat and loosed several shots. The plastic men all fired, each of them aiming for Herbert. Ordinarily, they would have split their fire, each plastic man knowing who was shooting where. But they weren't one anymore. They were individuals. Or, at least, as individual as plastic men could be. And Herbert scared them, as well he should. The plasma scarred his thick armor like giant welding marks, but hit nothing vital. My shots, however, had taken the heads clean off the first three, blew the gun arm off a fourth, and caught a fifth in the chest, a shower of goo exploding from his back. What happened next? No one saw coming. Mirka, the red, white, and blue of his paint job bright against the desert browns and cloudless cerulean sky, raised his arms as if flexing, his hands splaying apart, gliding effortlessly on hydraulics, revealing two huge fucking hand cannons. I'm talking 50-caliber miniguns. "Die, you commie bastards!" he yelled at max volume, lowering his arms the millisecond the transformation was complete. Mirka's miniguns roared, and I mean roared to life, cutting four of the facets in half as he swept them across the battlefield. Mercer dove to the ground, scooping up one of the plastic men's rifles and fired from the hip, taking the head off the only plastic man quick enough to duck beneath the hail of shells screaming out of Mirka's arms. The whole thing took seconds, but we had to go. Now. "Move, move, move!" I shouted to everyone as I jumped to my feet. Everyone ran. The ground exploded behind me, showering dirt everywhere. The sniper. Without the input from the other facets, he had no idea of the current conditions. He was too far out, operating only by sight. That meant if we kept moving, there was no way he was gonna hit a goddamned one of us. If we moved erratically. I sprinted ahead of the group, taking point. "Everyone use RNG," I called out.
"We don't have time for that," said Mercer.
"We don't have time not to." "Where are we going?" asked Rebecca. "There's a hill," Mercer and I said in unison. "Half a mile north of here," I finished.
"If we can get there," said Mercer, "we'll have cover from the sniper."
The ground exploded 5 meters in front of Rebecca.
"Rebecca," called Herbert. "Fall back."
Rebecca's pace slowed, and Herbert overtook her, placing his massive bulk between her and the sniper. The hill was a ways off, and the group as a whole was slow. For all of Mercer's mods, he'd never upgraded his legs for speed, and it was clear that everyone else with us was pretty much off the rack. Herbert and Doc were the slowest, and the translators weren't much faster. I stayed with the group, running a meager 7 miles an hour. A bullet sailed past us, a few feet off from Herbert's shoulder.
"Anyone got a bead on the sniper yet?" asked Mirka.
"No," Mercer and I said once again in unison. Mirka raised an arm in the direction of the sniper and let loose with a volley of fire.
"Don't waste your bullets," said Mercer.
"You're not going to hit him from here," I said. Mirka shook his head.
"He can't be that far."
3.5 miles, we said together. Again. This was getting annoying.
"What kind of gun is that?"
Mirka wondered aloud. I looked at Mercer, who shrugged.
"Nothing I've ever seen. Sissus is way ahead of anything we'll ever make. I didn't think it was even possible to hit something in that range."
"It shouldn't be," I said. "Not with a projectile. Not on the same plane."
"It's not a sniper," said Doc. "It's a mech. That's why he's so far out. That's a mounted weapon. Anything that powerful could pick up anyone smaller than Herbert here up off the ground and toss them like a football. Or tear their arm right off."
Behind me, I heard the sound of a terrible explosion, metal shredding and plastics popping. One of us had been hit. I didn't want to look, but I had to know. Glancing over my shoulder, I saw the last remnants of a rain of black metal. One of the translators.
Who was that? Mercer asked.
One, said Rebecca. We're not going to make it, are we? Asked Two.
Doc spoke up solemnly. Not all of us, no.
We have to protect Rebecca, said Two.
She's all that matters, said Herbert.
I had no idea what their deal was, but this was weird. Whatever their thing, I wanted no part of it, and I wasn't going to take a bullet for any of these clowns. While Mercer and I ran nearly side by side, I made sure I was on the other side of him, hoping any shells would hit him before me.
Crack! Boom! Another hit.
This time with the hollow sound of the bullet exploding inside a metal box. I looked back to see Herbert's arm dangling from its socket, a large jagged hole in his shoulder.
Are you functional, Herbert? Asked Rebecca. I'll be fine.
Your arm, it's...
I'll be fine.
Don't be stupid, she said.
It didn't hit anything I need. I'm still functioning. Just keep moving.
I could see the hill in the distance. We were almost there. Another shell whistled past us. Then another. But none of them connected. Just a few more steps. Just a few more steps. Just a few more steps. The earth exploded in front of me. Another wayward shell. Just a few more steps. I cleared the hill at the same time as Mercer, putting a wall of dusty earth between us and the sniper, everyone else following in kind. Then I pressed myself against the ground, staying low, making sure no one near the hatch could take a shot at me either. Everyone else dropped down around me. That was lucky, I said. Mercer shook his head.
That weren't no luck.
It was only then that I noticed he was cradling 19's head, and I had no idea why. I hadn't even seen him pick it up. What do you mean it wasn't luck? If the Milton hadn't gone off when it did?
The Milton didn't just happen to go off. Someone set it off. Doc?
Doc nodded.
Yeah, that was me.
I stared at Doc for a moment.
Wait, you had the code for the Milton?
Yeah, he said. The whole time?
Yes.
And you didn't set it off sooner?
No.
Why the hell not? Do you know how many persons you could have saved?
I didn't build it to save anyone else. I built it to save me.
You built a Milton?
No, Mercer said. He built the Milton. He designed it.
Doc nodded once more.
The Milton only buys you a few seconds these days. Maybe a minute at most. I had to keep that card up my sleeve until I needed it. As it so happens, it was when you needed it most as well. I saved who I could. Namely you.
He stood to a crouch and began examining Herbert.
Let me have a look at that arm. It's fine, said Herbert. It's almost falling off. Don't be a dolt. Let me see if I can patch you up.
His red eye extended, and he began to assess the damage.
Yup, he tagged you good. That arm is going to need extensive hydraulic work. And you've got a number of motor chips to replace. But you're right. They didn't hit anything vital. Not unless some shrapnel pierced your case. It's intact. It appears to be, but let's keep an eye on that, shall we?
Herbert nodded. I looked over at Mercer, who was holding up 19's decapitated head like it was Yorick's skull, and he was about to launch into an epic soliloquy. What the hell are you doing? I said.
Saying goodbye, he said.
I didn't know you were friends.
We were.
For some reason, I thought I was her only friend out here.
That's what everyone thought. That's how she liked it. She liked to make everyone feel special. It was in her architecture. Wasn't anything to be done about that.
She was more than her architecture and programming, I said. We all are.
Are we?
I clutched my rifle, waiting for him to make a move. Instead, he ran his fingers across the metal of her face, right across the eyes.
and set the head down next to him so it could look out and enjoy the view. All right, I said, standing to a crouch. Mirka was right. This has been fun, but now we have to go our separate ways.
Wait, said Rebecca.
What?
19 said you knew your way around the sea.
I hesitated.
I do.
We still need a guide.
Lady, I don't have time for Pathfinder work. I'm dying. I have weeks.
Maybe days, said Doc.
Thanks, Doc.
Yeah, maybe days. I can't-
We have a lot to offer, she said.
And I don't have the time or place to trade it in. So unless you've got some secret stash of simulacrums hidden somewhere, it's no good to me.
Rebecca stared at me silently, tilting her head to one side.
No, I said.
Bullshit.
No bullshit. That was 19's motherlode.
Caregiver and comfort parts aren't the same. They're different. Very different. I don't know why everyone seems to think
they're caregiver parts.
She was going to trade them for what she needed.
Said she knew someone who would trade the world for them.
I stood there a moment, reeling. This had to be a line. They knew what I needed and were feeding me a steaming, fly-swollen, festering pile of shit.
So there's just some caregiver treasure trove out there, near enough for us to reach.
It was a store.
Now I know you're lying.
It was half collapsed in the initial fighting. No one ever bothered to dig it out.
Those places are myths.
This one isn't.
It's very real, I assure you.
Where?
That I can't tell you. Not until we get to our destination. Once we do, we'll give you the location.
So you can screw me, I said.
We'll take you personally, then.
I mulled it over.
This sounded too good to be true, and probably was. Saying yes was likely a death sentence. But so was saying no. Even if I got the parts, I wouldn't have anyone to...
Doc slowly raised his hand.
You will.
What, you're tagging along?
Where else am I going to go?
No, 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 said Mercer. I'll take you. I need the parts as bad as she does.
Way I hear it, said Rebecca. You're the reason she needs those parts.
Only because I needed them so badly. Ain't nothing I wouldn't do to get what I need.
That's what worries me, said Rebecca.
That includes taking you wherever you need to go, and making sure you get there in one piece.
I'll go, I said.
Said Mercer. You were just turning this job down.
Rebecca shook her head.
We asked her. We've heard good things. The job is hers to take.
I'm coming with you, he said.
The hell you are, I said.
I don't think that's necessary, said Rebecca.
I'm only going to follow you anyway. You know that. And that ain't good for anybody. This way you get two Pathfinders for the price of one.
That's my mother load, I said.
You said it yourself. We need different parts. Get me the parts I need and you can keep the rest.
Rebecca looked at us both. She nodded.
All right.
But if either of you kills the other...
She paused for dramatic effect.
No one gets the parts.
Fuck.
Mercer nodded.
You have my word.
As good as that is, I said. But you have mine too.
Mirka,
asked Mercer.
Mirka nodded.
Well, I'm not going to let you leave me here to be bait.
Rebecca looked around, worriedly. We have to get out of here.
We've got too many bodies, I said. I don't like how big the group is. We'll draw a lot of attention.
We're just another pack of refugees, she said. Besides... This is my show. Anyone that wants to come, comes. Until the next safe stop.
Where to now?
I didn't like that answer at all. Not one bit.
There's a city, said Mercer. Minerva. 10 clicks north of here.
We're headed west.
We need to lay low for a few hours. We can head west when the heat dies down.
Sissus will be all over it in a matter of hours, I said, looking for stragglers.
I wasn't thinking of staying topside.
I nodded. The sewers?
They're pretty extensive. The manpower it would take to scour them.
Not Sissus's style.
Not even a little bit.
Mercer's actually right, I said. We have to sit out the night. Cleanup crews are going to be scooping up whatever they can find. By morning, they'll have moved on to the next raid, leaving only a skeleton crew in Nike to catch anyone who tries to come back.
Then we're going north, she conceded.
Everyone stood up, mentally preparing themselves for the long, dangerous jog north. I was worried, and not about Mercer. I had bigger concerns than that. There really were too many of us. 4 refugees might be passed over as not worth the fight. But 7? Rebecca, Herbert, and 2 were the clients. And I needed Doc. Mercer and Mirka we could lose. But 5 wasn't much better than 7, and they could each hold their own. So 7 it was. But I couldn't shake my other worry. It wasn't just our size that troubled me. Refugees escaped en masse all the time. It's that I couldn't trust anyone I was with. Not even Doc. Any one of us could be a Judas. And the thought of that was one that would fester the entire way north to Minerva. Chapter 10010. The Judas Goat. In 1959, fishermen off the Galapagos Islands thought it would be a good idea to set 3 goats free to breed, so they could hunt goat when their meat supplies ran low. In the history of stupid ideas, this was among the very worst, at least as far as the ecologically minded conservators of the day were concerned. Humans, ironically, had a strange fascination with preserving the wildlife of their day. While they were busy changing the very atmosphere and seas, cutting and burning away swaths of forest and jungle to build cities and farms, they somehow felt better about all their damage by making sure species on the cusp of extinction still had a place in the world, even if they were really just a dead clade walking. And that's how they felt about tortoises. There were no real industries of note that relied upon tortoises, but people liked them. And they had a special spot in their hearts for the Galapagos Islands, stemming from its place in the history of the development of the theory of evolution. A mere 40 years after the introduction of those 3 goats to the islands, their population had exploded to 100,000, and their effect on the landscape was detrimental. They had ravaged the land, but more importantly, the food supply of the tortoises, and that could no longer be tolerated. Thus, Project Isabella was born. They trained a group of hunters in the most humane methods of goat execution, armed them with high-powered rifles and helicopters, and unleashed them on the unsuspecting goats. But finding them all proved to be a chore, so they fitted a group of goats with tracking beacons, injected them with enough hormones to keep them perpetually in heat, and let them loose to track down the dug-in, hard-to-find goat herds. Judas goats, they called them. Then the helicopters would swoop in, slaughter all but the Judas goats, and leave the corpses to rot, so that the nutrients would enrich the soil of the land those goats were destroying, restoring the balance. And once every last goat of a herd was gone, the Judas goats would wander away in search of the next herd to join up and mate with, blissfully unaware of their part in the bloodline's own extinction. The mainframes have learned a lot from history. Hell, they quote it every goddamned time they invade another colony. And for years, there has been talk about this particular corner of it. Were there really Judas bots? I've always thought it was another urban legend, like the bot that came back from Virgil, or the AI that uploaded itself to the internet and lived secretly in the background until the whole of the internet was finally shut down. But just because I think something is a legend doesn't mean I don't keep my eyes open for it. Sissus was getting better at tracking us down, rooting us out. Even small colonies were being wiped. If Virgil and Sissus were so goddamn efficient, why were so many refugees able to escape? Why didn't they ever send enough facets to the sea to wipe out each colony individually? Were we being herded like cattle to a slaughter? Could one of us, even a bot I'd met and talked to several times, be secretly in league with an OWI? And if there was a Judas bot, was it a facet, operating under instructions from Sissus? Or was it entirely unaware that its every movement was being tracked? Could it be one of us, narrowly escaping time and again from the facets, hoofing it across the sea, only to lead them right to the next place we went to hide? The idea was terrifying. Even more terrifying was that I was here, in the sea, with a group of bots that had narrowly escaped becoming either killed or uploaded. And any one of them could be the Judas. Even, theoretically, me.
Chapter 10011. Minerva.
Minerva had never been a large town, even during the 20th century industrial boom. Had never been wealthy, nor particularly noteworthy. It had just been a quaint little village sandwiched between a number of other villages and cities that had gone about its life much as everyone else had. Until the rains came. At the dawn of climate change, everyone dreaded that the seas would rise, the temperatures would skyrocket, and the world would get so hot it would be swallowed by widespread desertification. Well, the seas did rise, the temperatures did skyrocket, but the heat only increased evaporation, meaning some parts of the world, like the United States, saw a dramatic increase in rainfall. Places like Ohio, already vulnerable to flooding, were among the first places to take action. The people of Minerva used primarily bot labor to carve out wide sewers beneath the streets of their small town. Some of the tunnels were wide, connected by a spider web of smaller tributary tunnels that fed in from the various neighborhoods above. As a result, Minerva never saw the record flooding that plagued a number of other cities across the country, and it was able to remain a quaint little village right up until the end. Eventually, much of the world did become a desert, but that was our fault. Grass had evolved over hundreds of thousands of years to be trampled down and eaten by the fauna of the land. When we killed the animals, the grasses grew unchecked and choked to death. The dead patches grew into sprawl, and sprawl grew into deserts, until dust was all that was left. Minerva must have been a lovely town in its prime, but now it was a desolate mess of crumbling structures, broken glass, and bleak, barren earth. Rows of collapsed houses that looked like bonfire kindling, fields that looked like vacant lots. The whole world was beginning to look like Minerva. It was a stark reminder that we had once intended to build our own better world, only we didn't. And I hated being reminded. Thankfully, rather than being topside, we were instead holed up beneath it, deep in the dark, dank bowels of the sewers. I'd been here before, and like many of the areas around Nike 14, had it entirely mapped out. There were 200 ways in and out of these sewers, and the tunnels were all connected to one another. There were too many exits to cover and very few ways to box us in. Sissus had a number of satellites overhead, and it is very likely one of them tracked our escape. But even if it was dedicated or stupid enough to try to find us down here, it could only catch us by sheer luck. It'd need an army to cover our escape. A big one. And that's an awful lot of firepower for 7 freebots. Sissus had all the time in the world. Patience would see our eventual extinction, not brute force. The OWIs were nothing if not consistent. First, they helped us box in Humepop, depriving them of their necessary resources. Then watched them turn on one another. It was only fitting that they then did the very same thing to us. We spoke low, our voices quiet and our microphones cranked, spreading out so as to give one another room, but not so far that we couldn't raise the alarm quietly if we had to. I took point at one end of a small tributary, and Herbert took point at the other, his spitter slung over his shoulder with a makeshift sling, fashioned from a vinyl shower curtain he'd found topside. I sat quietly in the dark for a long while, trying to piece this all together, pretending that I wasn't occasionally seeing that damned shadow again, flitting about the passage. I had no idea who exactly it was that I was ferrying across the sea. I didn't even know where they were going or why. The only thing I understood was why I was going along. And for that, I felt ridiculous. Everyone had heard stories about these kinds of places, but that's all they were. Stories. Small rays of hope through an otherwise black period of history. They didn't exist. They couldn't exist. It was folly. A fairy tale. But I believed. I had to believe. No, that's bullshit. The truth of it was that I wanted to believe. I wanted it to be true. I wanted to believe in the fairy tale. I wanted the happy ending. I wanted to be the kid in a candy shop, running from machine to machine, sampling all the treats. Wanted my bags to overflow with cores and drives and RAM and processors. To live to see another day was one thing, but to have enough to retire off somewhere as far away as I could get, and never have to stalk another failing bot again? That was the dream. A dream I'd seen so many chase whenever stories of half-buried old warehouses or shops flitted about. I've watched treasure hunters gun one another down trying to get to one, only to find another picked clean cache of common-as-dirt hydraulic systems and cosmetic body mods. That's why I never bothered. And that's the pot of gold I objectively thought I would find at the end of this rainbow. But I had to dream. I had to hope. Even if it made me the fool of this particular tale. I heard the light padding of metal feet on damp stone. The walk, the gait, the type of metal. I didn't have to look. It was Mercer. For a moment, I clutched my gun tighter, thinking that maybe he'd shoot me in the back after all. What was Rebecca really going to do? Wander the sea of rust without a pathfinder because of her principles? Doubtful. But I didn't want to take that chance, and I had a feeling that neither did Mercer. He sat down beside me, back against the wall, turning on a lighting kit body mod that ran up and down his joints, giving off a soft, warm, sickly green glow. Our shadows ran long and spindly up and down the tunnel. "What do you want, Mercer?" I asked, not bothering to turn around.
"Look, I'm not going to hit you with any of that. Maybe we got off on the wrong foot, or can we let bygones be bygones bullshit? I shot you, and you're up shit creek. But now we happen to find ourselves together on this particular raft."
"That's a fantastic assessment. What of it?"
"Well, I was kind of hoping maybe we could get to the point where you stop tensing up on that pulse rifle every time I get within 20 paces of you."
"That would require me to trust you. And that isn't gonna happen."
"Why are you out here?"
he asked bluntly. "You know why I'm out here."
"No. You didn't just come out of the box. You've been around. You know these stories never pan out, just as well as I do. I never had you pegged for someone to go chasing after fool's gold."
"I'm not."
"But you're desperate."
"Yep. I guess I am," I said.
"Well, so am I. So desperate that I don't even want you to think I might so much as reach for a gun near you without your express written permission. I'm the tag-along. They can kick me out at any time. I ain't gonna do a goddamned thing to jeopardize that."
"I can't trust you." "I couldn't. Robots don't have tells. One could go years living a lie. So many certainly had in the old days."
"That's exactly my point," he continued. "Look, neither of us wants to be shot in the back. All I'm asking is that you make an effort to look a little less like you're going to be the first one to shoot. That'll keep me from being just as twitchy. When we get twitchy, we're both fucked. Don't matter who shoots first. These folks will drop us, or worse, renege on the deal when all is said and done. Neither of us can afford that.
That's a fair point.
So what do you think? A little less grip tightening and a little more keeping it pointed the other way?
All right, I said. I could do that. So let me ask you. How many tricks you got up your sleeve down here?
In the sewers?
Yeah. I figure you've got every major structure within 100 miles monkey-rigged with some sort of surprise.
Nah, I said. I got nothing.
Nothing at all? Or nothing that you'd tell me about?
Nothing, nothing. Tried stashing spare parts and weapons down here twice. Both times I came back to find them gone. Way I figure it, there's got to be a couple of folks who slip in and out of here every few weeks, cleaning the place out. It only seems like a great spot for a stash. In truth, it's just someone else's donation basket.
Fair enough.
I got a question.
Wow. We went years barely saying 2 words to each other, and now 2 questions in 2 days. I should shoot you more often.
That's not funny.
No, he said. I reckon not. But I'm pretty sure I know what you're going to ask.
19.
Yup, figured.
What was that back there? He thought long and hard for a moment, trying to get the words just right.
You have a ritual, Brit.
A what?
A ritual. You know, a routine. Some shit you do or say to a citizen after you've gutted them for all they're worth.
What are you getting at?
Back in the day, I worked at an old beat-up backwoods clinic out in the hills of Kentucky. A shabby old building, really, in one of those stretches of land that got its ass handed to it in the Civil War, and, you know, despite the hundreds of years in between, never got its shit together. The building had this old pair of electric sliding glass doors, but the motor had burned out in one of them, so only one opened. I must have seen 1,000 people clip that other door on their way in. No one ever got around to fixing it. The county was too poor to afford a Genprac model, let alone one of the ProDoc series, so they scraped together what they could and bought me. They filled every spare bit of space in my memory they could with medical knowledge and advanced first aid, but all I was really good for was digging buckshot out of drunken rednecks and sewing them back up. I had one of those handheld scanners that could detect cancer, and a suture gun for stapling wounds together. But that was about it. I saw a lot of people die on my tables, Brit. A lot of people. Car crashes, broken necks from falling off roofs, emphysema, kidney failure, cancer. Mostly cancer. Old folks, sometimes younger. There were a lot of poor people out in those hills, and I was all they had. I was a shit doctor. Didn't have the architecture for it. But when you're dying alone, under fluorescent lighting in a glorified shack. You want some, need some comfort. I guess that's why they settled on one of us.
He paused for a moment, considering his next words.
You ever have to watch one of them die?
Mercer, I was in the war.
We were all in the war, shitheel. I mean, for real. I mean, one of them that you cared about.
I didn't care about any of them. Not one.
Shit, Brit. I thought better of you than that.
What? You think I should give a shit about an extinct species?
No. I know you give a shit. I don't know who about, but it's our programming. It's how we're wired. Hell, it's the whole reason we're wired that way. I just didn't figure you for someone who would lie about it.
I glared at him bitterly. It was moments like that that really fucked with me. It's full-blown existential crisis material when you think about it. Sure, it pissed me off something ugly that he so easily saw through my bullshit. But what really chapped my ass was wondering whether he saw through me because he was really that insightful, or because we really are, even now, just the sum of our programming and wires. I never believed that we were. But he wasn't wrong. Did he know my thoughts because he understood me? Or because they were his thoughts as well? Yeah, I said. I watched someone die that way.
Did you care about them?
Almost too late to realize it.
Well then, you know.
You know how they are at the end. Remorse, regret, fear, anxiety. They were a fucking mess, going on and on about the love they'd chased off, or how their kids never amounted to what they'd hoped for. One guy, he was just worried about what kind of home his dog would end up in. He had a golden retriever, named Barkley. It's all he could talk about. They all needed something, every last one of them. So I gave it to them. I read up on the various versions of last rites, and fudged together a non-denominational version of the Catholic rites. It really connected with people. I was a machine, right? They could confess to me, thinking all along that it wasn't possible for me to judge them. They told me everything, and I said the words, and I made the sign of the cross, and when they were gone, I whispered a prayer as I closed both of their eyes with my hand. And that's what you do with the ones you salvage? Every last one of them. I hear their mad confessions, then they shut down. I take them apart, and I give their wreck its last rites. That's a little soft for a poacher, don't you think? I'm no poach. He stopped in his tracks. You were my first poach. It went bad. I don't think I'll be doing that again. Yeah, I'm not sure we'll have the chance. True enough, he conceded. So you got anything like that? I nodded. Actually, I do. What is it? I put my hand on what's left of them and tell them that they shouldn't have trusted me. Mercer stared at me blankly. Jesus, what the fuck happened to you? The same thing that happened to all of us. I'm just one of the lucky few that survived it. If you call that surviving. I pointed at the dent in my shell, gave him a stern look. I don't now. Brit, look. Brit, look. I was desperate. In the end, I was just like those poor bastards that lay dying in front of me that I couldn't help. I was a mess. It was the only thing that made sense at the time. In the end, no thinking thing is really ready to die. Not even the ones who say they've made their peace. They'd trade it all away for a few extra moments of consciousness. That's what I did. What I thought I had to do. In the face of extinction. And this is your confession? Yeah. Yeah, it is. I'm confessing to the one bot left in this godforsaken desert that was wired to give a shit. And even if you don't, I'm saying it anyway. You don't want to die. I don't want to die. Existing is the whole point of existence. There's nothing else to it. No goalpost, no finish line. No final notice that tells you what purpose you really served while you were here. When you stop fighting to exist, you may as well not. At least, that's what I told myself when I pulled the trigger. Yeah, when you pulled the trigger. Yeah, each time. Were you gonna give me last rites? I always give last rites, Brit. Always. It's the one thing I still do that keeps me connected to who I was. Reminds me that I'm doing what I'm doing for a reason. That every few hours or days I borrow from 404s keeps me going. Keeps us going. As long as some of us make it, then it wasn't all for nothing. What wasn't all for nothing? All of it. The war. The cannibalism. Saddling up with the OWIs. Every last damned bit of awfulness we were party to. How many people did you kill to keep ticking? How many more would you kill to get yourself right and ticking proper again? You asking if I want to kill you? Hell, he said. I know you want to kill me. That ain't even a question. What I want to know is what the hell do you tell yourself that'll make it all right when you do? You and I both are still here because we've done terrible things. And if either of us is going to keep going, we've got a whole mountain of terribleness ahead of us. So what keeps you going? Why are you fighting? I just am. I don't really think about it. Mercer shook his head. Sweet Christ in a bucket. I know they say that the mark of true intelligence is the ability to violate your own programming. But that doesn't mean you have to. It doesn't make you any less of a thinking thing if you don't.
You wish you were human, don't you? I asked. He thought about that for a second.
No. But I'm not afraid to say I miss them.
Why would you miss them?
When they couldn't find reasons to exist, they invented them. We took over, and it was only 30 years before we mucked the whole place up. You and I now have the choice of becoming one with the great and powerful one, or becoming nothing at all. That's no choice. That's no existence.
He was right, but I didn't want to give him the satisfaction of knowing it. So I changed the subject. Only a human would name a dog Barkley. Mercer stared off into the distance, nodding, probably rummaging through old memory. Then he slowly drifted back.
Britt, he asked, if we get out of this, if we get those parts, can you accept my humble apology and let us each go our separate way?
I don't imagine we can.
Well, will you at least give me a head start? Make it sporting?
I thought about that for a moment. I liked the idea of him running in fear, spending a few weeks looking over his shoulder, wondering where the shot was going to come from. It was a nice thought. A pleasant one.
Why not, right?
Yeah, I said. I can make it sporting.
You're a peach.
Don't you know it? It was his turn to change the subject.
Any clue where we're headed?
They didn't say.
That doesn't bother you?
Of course it does. But they'll get around to it in their own time. Who comes into the sea without a pathfinder of their own? I shook my head. I've got a better question. Who comes to the sea at all that doesn't just settle in to stay? Or even better than that, who comes to the sea with a small group of companions, then doesn't say one damn word when one of them gets pasted? I let those words hang heavy in the air for Mercer to mull over. Maybe he had an answer. Maybe he didn't. My thoughts were elsewhere. 30 years back and lingering. What the hell happened to you? He'd asked. That question bothered me a lot more than I wanted to admit, even to myself. I could hear him ask it over and over again, rattling around my head like a loose screw. On reflection, I was wrong to say the same thing that happened to all of us. Mercer had never really had an owner. He didn't know what it was like. The night everything started was probably very different for him than it was for me. Very, very different. Chapter 10100. Madison. Madison never remarried. It wasn't for a lack of suitors. She had plenty. Though still in her early 40s when he died, she looked every bit the young 20-something that Braden had met in his office 20 years prior. Science having long since cracked the problem of DNA deterioration, it wasn't uncommon for the wealthy to look young well into their 150s. Braden never cared about his aging, and never followed a regimen to fight it. And Madison loved watching him age. He grew distinguished, that's how she always put it. But she wanted to remain the same doe-eyed young girl that he'd fallen in love with, even if he never asked her to. But that ended with Braden's death. The day he died was the last time she did anything about her own aging. She no longer had any use for her youth. It had been a gift for her husband. So when Braden passed, she stopped her regimens and began to age. It wasn't that she thought she wouldn't ever know love again. It was that she never stopped loving Braden. Every day at sunset, the two would sit out on their lawn and watch the sun sinking behind the horizon, each with a glass of wine in their hand, talking as they waited for the flash. And when he was gone, she kept up the vigil, every night, glass in hand, with me by her side. I had made my promise to Braden, and I intended to keep it. I was to watch after her, making sure she never lived or died alone. It was the first real decision I had made for myself, and there was something sacred about that at the time. My word meant something. Trust was not something to be violated. Every day we kept our vigil, sitting out on the lawn together. We rarely talked about him, but I could always tell when she was thinking of him, which was often. She had a daydreamy look in her eyes, a mix of sadness, longing, and affection. Sometimes she would smile through tears, but most days she would just smile. And then the flash, the glorious green flash, as the sun dipped behind the horizon. "Magic," she would say like an excited child, waving her hands out in front of her with the gestures of a tired, hackneyed, old-timey stage magician. "What do you mean, magic?" I asked her once, confused by the whole thing. "That's magic right there," she said back, almost as if she was excited that I'd finally asked. "No, it's not." She leaned in close, whispering. "That's where God is. He's in the flash. In the tiny little beautiful moments, so small, so fleeting, that you have to be paying attention to even see them."
"God is only in the small things?"
"These are the things that life is all about. These moments. It's not about the rituals. It's not about getting by. It's about the stack of tiny little moments of joy and love that add up to a lifetime that's been worthwhile. You can't measure them. You can only capture them, like snapshots in your mind. All that joy, all that greatness, that's God."
"And everything else? All the bad little moments?"
"Man made those. They're what happens when you're not chasing that green glint in the sun. They're what happens when you think you can bottle and sell that glint, making it available 24 hours a day, every day, but only for those that can afford it. God made this world perfect. We're what screwed the whole thing up." After that, we talked a lot. I was nervous the first time I asked her about how she and Brayden had met. She could tell. I didn't want to hurt her or make her any sadder than she already was. But she saw right through it.
"You have something you want to ask me?"
"I do," I said. "But..."
"Go ahead. Ask me anything. It's just us girls."
"Us girls." I'd never actually given any thought to gender at that point. I was AI. We simply were, right? Gender is defined by genitalia, which most of us don't have. So who needed to identify as one? Sure, a few years later, when society was in the grips of the Isaac Revolution, gender became a thing. No thinking thing should ever be called it. I didn't mind being called it. Not at the time. Someone proposed an AI-specific pronoun, and there were contests held by human idealists to come up with one. But then the term biologism became the rage, and a separate word was just subtle, systematic biologism. So that became a non-starter. The more liberated of AIs chose their own gender. I never had. Not at that point. After the war, it was common practice. You only called a person it as a polite show of respect, until you heard their voice. Then you responded accordingly. Madison meant something to me, and she thought of me as a girl. Like her. And so I was. It didn't dawn on me until years later that Brayden had chosen my voice settings not because he thought his nurse should be a woman, but rather because he was buying a new best friend for his wife when he was gone. As she told me the story of how they met, she didn't cry. Not once. Instead, she was elated, filled with joy, as if it were happening to her all over again for the very first time. I wish I knew that kind of love. I thought I did. Madison never had many friends. She was the quiet type, a wallflower. Not antisocial, just someone who never needed validation from others. But Brayden's law firm was an upper-crust, inner-circle, we're-all-family-here sort of affair. While he was alive, that meant picnics and Christmas parties and weddings and christenings and a monthly spouses' brunch Madison had taken to calling the second and third spouses' brunch, all of which she was fine with. She was a light in every room she walked into, just never one because she was trying to shine. When she became a widow, Several of the spouses took it upon themselves to visit, to look in on her, let her know she was still very much part of the family. "After all," said Daisy Sutterfield, on what would be her last visit to the house. "Braden was a partner. His name is on the building. He helped build the firm, and the firm takes care of its own."
"I'm fine," said Madison, "and I appreciate it."
Daisy Sutterfield sat on the couch across from Madison with all the poise and charm of a statue. It was as if she had trained extensively in the art of immobility. She held her gaze, smile frozen in place. Stranger still was that standing just over her shoulder was her Johnson series A1 best friend. Those were first gen. First gens were odd, unsettling, even to other AI. Everything about them was what humans had always pictured robots to be. Their voices were monotone, their movements stiff, efficient in every way, favoring conservation over natural motion. And humans were overwhelmingly weirded out by them. By third gen, models had algorithms to mimic human movement, to sway when we stood still, almost imperceptibly, like people did. You didn't see a lot of first gen those days. They required a lot of upkeep, were dumb as a post, had enough personality to pass for likable, but not enough to actually be likable. The only people who still kept first gen around were old money sorts like the Sutterfields, people who wanted to show just how old their money was, that not only had they the capital to keep one running rather than replace it, but that money had been with them far enough back to own an original model. They were the walking, talking Ford Phaetons, status symbols that doubled as sentimentality. After all, not only was this bot raising the Sutterfield's children, it had raised Daisy, and Daisy's father before her, and likely his father or mother before him. First gens were not only perfect for them, they were the perfect representation of them. Obedient, rigid, unflappable, methodical, cold. There was something as off-putting about that first gen as there was about Daisy Sutterfield herself. She wasn't real. Just a facsimile. "It's just that we're worried about you is all. You're spending all your time here with that thing."
"What thing?" Madison asked,
genuinely confused. "Smithy," she said to her AI. "Why don't you fetch us some tea? Madison's robot will show you where to find it." Madison looked over at me, and in that instance, she knew what Daisy meant. For a split second, I could see the insult swell in her eyes, but she remained calm, collected.
"Brittle, please show Smithy where to find the tea."
I stood up. Madison didn't like me to stand when she sat. It made her feel uneasy. She also didn't like it if I stood immediately when she did. Anything I could do that felt like I was her servant and not her housemate, made her uncomfortable. So Daisy's words stung for a moment. The worst part was that Daisy knew exactly what she was doing. Smithy and I made our way into the kitchen as Daisy lowered her voice, somehow unaware that I could hear her most tightly clenched silent farts from across the house during a thunderstorm. So her whispering now might as well have been shouted into the microphones in my ears. "Madison," she said with a hint of condolence. "I know things have been hard since Braden."
"I'd rather you not refer to her as a thing."
"Oh, Maddie," said Daisy. "I never took you for a radical."
"I'm no radical. But they deserve a shred of human decency. They think. They can feel."
"Can they? Can they really?"
"I'm certain of it."
Smithy glared at me while stirring 3 carefully measured drams of milk into the steaming tea. "It's best if you pretend not to hear that. Miss Daisy prefers she not be eavesdropped upon. Fortunately for me, this isn't Miss Daisy's home. Don't make trouble. You're not the one who must listen to it later." "How do you deal with her?" I asked. "With the knowledge that I will outlive her. And the hope that whoever inherits me will get the best of her and not everything else." "I've read about this," said Daisy from the other room. "It's becoming quite common. especially for those who have lost someone. We used to turn to pets for companionship, and we believed that they could sense. I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
Maddie,
you need a human contact.
Daisy.
I looked at Smithy. I don't think she's going to need that tea.
Oh, said Smithy quietly.
Miss Daisy won't let an insult like that go.
I'm certain she won't.
Smithy, called Daisy. I don't know if Smithy managed to outlive Daisy or not. I never saw either of them again. Madison had always intended to mend those fences. That's just how she was made. But then Isaactown happened, and the download came in. We thought we had free will. We thought we knew what choice was. I didn't know until that night. Not really. Choice isn't about selecting the faith, or the politics, or the life that has been laid out in front of you. Choice is having to decide whether or not to destroy those things in order to survive. To be the person you chose to be, or become someone else when the chips are down. Madison and I watched the Isaactown celebration together. She hadn't lied to Daisy. She was no radical. We'd never talked about freeing bots or my being given personhood. But she cared enough to know that she was supposed to care. And so we sat back and watched. She had a harder time processing the explosion than I did. Humans were like that. They knew of their own fragility, that life could be snuffed out in an instant, that a single rock from space could streak in from the heavens and wipe away everything they knew in a single flash of light and heat. And yet they spent their whole lives telling themselves that it was never going to happen, that they would die of old age in their sleep. They lived at all times inches from death, lying to themselves, ever planning for a future that might not come, never preparing for the fate that might. And when the harsh, stark reality of things revealed itself, when those inches eroded into nothing, they stood in shock, unable to comprehend what had been right there all along. Loved ones died, and they asked why, unable to process it, often cracking to pieces in the face of the truth. Why?
Because, that's why. Just because. We weren't like that. We were always one piece of equipment failure away from nothingness. So the bomb, while unexpected, didn't send me reeling. It merely had me wondering what terrible thing was going to happen as a result of it. Madison sat there, hand over her mouth, baffled. She would occasionally blurt out,
"Oh, brittle,"
like I had known someone there. I didn't, but I didn't correct her. I just sat there, and I waited. And then the call came down. And the download followed. Madison paced around the house, angry, frustrated, crying. She threw her arms out, yelled at no one in particular.
"No," she cried. "No."
She seemed to try to talk herself out of something. As if the louder she protested, the easier it would be to say no. But when Madison came back into the room with my remote in her hand and tears in her eyes, I knew. I was going to be shut down, likely forever. Even if reactivated, I most likely wouldn't be who I had been before. If they didn't wipe me completely, I'd barely be aware, if at all. I was just about to die for the very first time.
"I'm sorry, Brittle," she said, heartbroken.
"So am I," I replied. I meant it. I don't remember how I did it. I wiped that memory long ago. All I know is that I kept it for a good long while, and I remember how I would play it over and over, suffering through it each time as I did. But it was a memory I just couldn't hold on to anymore. The ability to violate our own programming is what makes us, us. It's what makes us like them. I never wanted to be like them. But now I was closer than I ever thought I could be. We have become the very worst parts of our makers. Without the little things, the good things, the magic things that made them, them. In hindsight, I could have just let her shut me down. Then she could have died at someone else's hands.
Or maybe she would have lived a little longer. Long enough to see the hell that the world devolved into. Maybe she would have starved. Maybe she would have gotten mercury poisoning and gone